So let's start with the same question we've asked everybody else, which is, why should the voters pick you and not the other two?
I think if you look at the record that I've established over the last 4 years of delivering on what I committed to when I ran for mayor 4 years ago, we have seen a remarkable transformation, not only of city government, but of community engagement and of how we look at every single neighborhood from a lens of equity. And the results of that have led to the rebuilding of parks that had been ignored for decades, the investment in infrastructure in neighborhoods that hadn't seen that level of investment in infrastructure. And we've started to solve the issues around the city's budget, modernizing City Hall, and making changes that aren't just about numbers. They're about giving us the resources that we need to continue to deliver services to our residents and to be able to continue to provide opportunities for our employees.
I think it was back when you presented your 2015 budget. This was the budget that included a lot of controversial items in it, the Ladder One thing, red light cameras, and some other things that ended up getting a lot of discussion. You made reference to the fact that you had to make some hard choices and that the city would continue to have to make hard choices. So as you look out to the next 4 years, what are some hard choices that you think the city is going to have to face and make?
Well, you know, we continue to have budgetary challenges, just like every other city, not just in New York State, but across the country. And we also are burdened with a high tax rate. So we can't look to taxpayers and to property taxes to solve those challenges. So we have a landfill that's closing, and that's going to require us to make sure that we start to change people's attitudes towards garbage in Albany. The city of Albany, I think, has really, because we've had our own landfill, because we pick everything up, that has created some bad habits. And so that is a challenge that we're going to have to address. And these are things that I have always been worked very hard to ensure that I'm not over-promising and under-delivering, and that I'm being straight with people and not telling them things that I know we can't possibly deliver on. So, you know, the choices that we made, you know, with respect to Ladder One, that was not a reduction in force. That was the fact that we had a fire department with one extra piece of apparatus based on a decision that was made by the prior administration. You know, they cut the department, but they didn't cut the apparatus, and so that drove overtime. We were able to negotiate a resolution with the union. They agreed to a concession in their contract that allowed us to get to most of the savings that we were trying to achieve by eliminating that apparatus and eliminating the overtime. We then went on to be successful in getting a SAFER grant so that we could bring our staffing levels back up to where they needed to be to staff all that apparatus. So I look at that as a demonstration of how you manage through adversity and how you look to ensuring that we can have the resources that we need at a cost that we can afford.
I think a lot of times in political campaigns, everything sounds like it's possible. You know, it's like people make promises. It's like, you know, we're all going to get to ride unicorns and have ice cream and it's not going to cost us anything extra. But, you know, of course, it never works out that way. And I'm especially kind of intrigued by how when you hear candidates talk, especially the people who are not the incumbents, you know, they make it sound like, well, when I'm mayor, everything's going to be different, and that it's just a matter of applying the will to get things done to change things. So now that you've had almost 4 years in this job, I'm curious about what your thoughts are on what the limitations of the power of the mayor are.
Well, I think that I always had a pretty realistic outlook as to what this job entails because of my background and my experience. I had been an attorney. I also was a senior executive for a company that grew from $90 million to over $300 million. And so I think that I brought to the job a level of experience and understanding that you can't just say things and expect them to happen. You have to have the right people in the right places doing the right things. And that takes time. And that sometimes can be frustrating, and particularly in government and in an environment where you have a number of competing interests that you almost have to triage and say, all right, I want to get to this particular point in our evolution with respect to, for example, code enforcement. But the reality was I didn't have a leader of that department that could get us to that point. And it took us a long time to find that leader. And so that's one of the limitations. That's where sort of ambition meets reality. And so no show of force is going to result in anything changing if you don't have the right leader in place. And then once we found that leader, the reality of, okay, I understand what you want me to accomplish, Mayor, but in order to do that, these are the tools that I need. And it takes time to put those tools in place. So I've always worked hard to be realistic and to set realistic expectations for our residents and to communicate the why. If we make this investment now, if we demonstrate some patience now, this is where it's going to lead us. And so when I hear about cutting revenues and eliminating, you know, fees and lowering taxes and also, on the other hand, giving people raises and starting a whole new department and all of these things, I look at it and I know that that's not achievable and it won't happen because it's just simply not possible. It is unicorns and ponies and puppies for everyone. And I think that the voters and our residents are smart enough to understand that. I have a lot of respect for our residents and our voters. When I'm out knocking on doors, people ask good questions, and I think that they're intelligent, and they want to hear something that they think actually adds up and makes sense.
I asked that question in part because I think that when you were elected, there were a lot of people in this city who had a lot of hopes about how things were going to go. You know, they were very excited about the prospect of change, you know, because Albany doesn't change mayors very often. And I think that they also saw you, not just you the person, but your election as a symbol that things were going to be different in some way. And, you know, in talking to some of them now, I think a lot of them are relatively happy. They're your supporters. But I think that some of them are also frustrated that things have not changed as much as they like. And I think just to use a small example, you know, out here on Madison Avenue with the Madison Avenue Road Diet, which I think on some level a lot of people have embraced so far, that the first section of it is actually very nice. There were people who had pushed very hard for protected bike lanes on there. Mm-hmm. And your administration ultimately chose not to go in that direction. And I think that, you know, when people saw that, you know, they thought to themselves, well, you know, if we get you in as mayor, we can really make some radical changes. We can make some big changes, some things that will, like, really change the course of things. And they feel like maybe you have pulled up a little bit short in that regard.
You know, let's start with sort of the expectations. And, you know, I think that people underestimate how radically things have changed. In 3+ years, we've managed to rezone the entire city. We have taken a 1990s IT system and brought it into the 21st century. And those two achievements alone provide us the foundation to continue to engage in becoming the progressive city with the innovation and with the types of amenities that we want for our city. When we talk about the protected bike lanes, I think that is a demonstration of my leadership style, and I bring everyone to the table. And ultimately, we drove our consultants to really give us apples to apples to apples comparisons of what was possible on Madison Avenue. And then I brought in not just the bike enthusiasts, but the residents who live along Madison Avenue and the businesses along Madison Avenue. And the trade-off was approximately 300 parking spaces along Madison Avenue. That was the trade-off. We could have protected bike lanes. We were going to lose 300 parking spaces. And we also were going to have issues with respect to snow removal and use of those protected bike lanes in the wintertime. And ultimately, the consensus was we wanted a successful project, and we didn't want the first project to fail because of that controversy and the firestorm that could have resulted from that loss of parking, and also the very significant concerns of businesses along Madison Avenue about the loss of parking. And so that's what leading and governing is all about. there, and I understand that there will be people who will be disappointed, but I don't think that that is a lack of vision. If you look at the resources that we've marshaled to take a three-phase project and do it in two phases, to then take the learnings from Madison Avenue and think about what we can do on Clinton and on Broadway, now that we understand what the trade-offs are, that we are moving the city in the right direction.
Do you think that situation says anything about how things change? Because I ask that because, you know, it seems like on some level, if you try to get everybody on board with a change, that almost always means you're going to make incremental change. And that if you're going to really change things a lot, that's going to involve making at least some people upset. Do you think that's true?
Well, you know, I think I've demonstrated that I'm willing to make people upset because ultimately you have to make a decision. And the decision with respect to Madison Avenue was that, you know, there was a cohort of people who said, if you build it, they will come. And in looking at the data and in looking at the examples that were given, we just ultimately believed that this was the right treatment for Madison Avenue, not necessarily for every street in the city. And so we've got to bring people along, and we've got to meet people where they are. I think with the addition now of the bike share program and the popularity of that, the increased use of bicycles that we're starting to see throughout the city, that we have the ability to then take that to the next level and work to fully implement the bicycle master plan that was originally envisioned for the city and that was developed a number of years ago. And so in looking at the goals that we have for moving our city forward and looking at all of the different competing, you know, resources or need for resources that we have, I think that we have a successful project on Madison Avenue, and that that will lead to more successful projects and more of an acceptance of bicycles and bike lanes. We're doing a protected bike lane for the connector between the rail trail and the Corning Preserve Trail. So, you know, getting people to see what that's like. And I do think that there's a significant opportunity on Broadway because that is an evolving commercial district as opposed
in
to...
In the warehouse district.
Right, in the warehouse district, as opposed to what we were dealing with along Madison Avenue.
Okay, so flip things to the other side. People who were not supporters of you. In talking with some of them in this election, it's kind of reminded me of this, I think, this thing that's true about politics that we don't necessarily always like to acknowledge, which is that elections a lot of times aren't necessarily about what we sort of rationally think. They're about what we feel. Mm-hmm. You know, we like to think that, like, oh, well, I just line up the policies, and if I agree with all these things, I'm going to vote for that person. But it's a lot of times it's about how people feel about a person. And in talking with people who are not supporters of you, what I've been struck by is that a lot of times here and there they have policy issues with you that they disagree with. But to a large degree, to me, it seems that there's something about your administration, maybe about your style, that they feel is a little cold or a little corporate, a little distant in some way, or maybe doesn't take into account what people have to say or think. So for those people, what do you have to say to them to help close that gap?
You know, I think that in the first 6 months that I was in office, we were hit with a fire hose. I think people had this idea that they would be able to just come in and sit down and, you know, we'd be able to have a conversation and you know, listen to their great ideas for what they wanted for the city of Albany. And the reality is that I have a city to run. And so in looking at what we were able to accomplish in those first 6 months, I think we accomplished a tremendous amount. But I know that there were ruffled feathers. There were people who felt as though they should have just had unfettered access. And I think if you had been in City Hall today as teenage boys from Green Tech Charter School, came in waves into City Hall during a school project that they had called Pay It Forward, and having these, you know, big teenage boys come up and give me a big hug and, you know, say, hey, Mayor, it's good to see you. You always support us. You know, I think that I am who I am. I'm not a, you know, I followed a very slap you on the back, you know, pat you on the face kind of guy in Jerry Jennings. And I'm not going to apologize for who I am. But to those who I encounter throughout the city, I engage in very deep conversations with them about what they're concerned about, from whether it's their block or their concerns about the city. And I'm just going to continue to do that and continue to be there for people. And I, you know, I love this city. I love the people here. And I am here to ensure that people have an ear and have a voice in City Hall and in my administration. And so, you know, I think to anybody who has a concern as to whether or not it's corporate, you know, they need to understand the why. I mean, why I'm trying to make City Hall more effective and efficient is so that we can meet the needs of our residents. I mean, there's no other reason to do this. It's about our neighborhoods. It's about people who feel forgotten and left out of the process. That's why I do what I do and why I want to ensure that we have a City Hall that's fair for everyone, that is focused on rebuilding neighborhoods, that's focused on bringing hope back to neighborhoods, connecting people to jobs, and that's who I am.
One of the topics during your first administration that got a lot of discussion was red light cameras, mm-hmm. Which was kind of a fascinating thing to me, I thought, leading up to it, seeing everybody's perspectives on that. Do you plan on continuing that program?
Well, they're installed and they're operating, and they don't cost us any money. So as long as they are keeping intersections safer, I think that it's a good public safety move. And I think that, you know, this was another issue that, you know, people, from the standpoint of the revenue miss, right, you know, we've missed in prior administrations on revenue projections for sales tax by millions of dollars. This was a revenue projection that missed, and we knew we were going to miss it, and so we managed to it. But I said from the very beginning, and I meant what I said, it was never about the revenue. And our three-year projections had revenue falling to de minimis amounts, which is where we are now. This was about responding to a advisory committee that the police department put together that made this recommendation. It didn't come from me or my administration. This ball had already started rolling before I took office. And this was the number one recommendation from an advisory group of residents that was advising the police department. And the recommendation for red light cameras came out of the police department. As a matter of fact, when I ran for city treasurer, my Republican opponent talked about installing red light cameras as a way to get revenue for the city. And I opposed it. I opposed it from the standpoint of doing it simply for revenue. That the only reason to install red light cameras is to enhance public safety, not as a revenue grab. And I said it over and over again. I meant it, and it has played out exactly as I anticipated. My Republican opponent, when I ran for treasurer, I thought was overestimating what the revenue would be. I actually pushed really hard on the police department because they're the ones that provided the revenue projection. And I didn't believe it. I allowed myself to become convinced of it. And I chalked that up to one of those issues where I'm not going to let that happen again.
I'm glad you bring that up because, and I think you're right to point out that there are two issues here. There's the safety issue, and then there's also the revenue issue. And I think that, in some ways, the most important part about the revenue part of this is understanding the process that went that your administration went through in making the decision about putting that $2 million into the budget. Because one of the, one of the questions I had leading up to the whole red light camera decision was this idea of that I didn't get the sense that anybody really had a good idea of what the scale of the problem was. I mean, I think if you talk to people, everybody say, yes, I have definitely seen people run red lights. It's a problem. It happens all the time at the end of my street. But there weren't necessarily good numbers to point that this is the level of incidence of it. So it was hard to make, it seemed like it was hard to make that estimate about how much revenue there was going to be.
Well, actually, what really drove the change in revenue was the request by a common council member to ensure that we had 4 second yellows. And
which is a thing that's recommended by
right.
a lot of transportation
right.
nerd type people.
So and that has made a big difference. It's made a huge difference. Now, I don't know if we took the red light cameras away and we just had 4 second yellows throughout the city, whether we would see that the problem is solved or if accidents would creep back up. But I'm certainly willing to explore that. You know, so that part of it, I think, is still the jury is still out on that. But that change to 4 second yellows clearly reduced the number of tickets that were ultimately issued. And I think that's a good thing. I have no qualms with that. But I believe that ultimately the consultants that came up with the projections came up with those projections based on a formula that did not factor in a 4 second yellow.
I mean, it was wildly off.
Yeah.
I mean, last year there were 12,800 red light camera violations issued by the city.
Mm-hmm.
That's, roughly what, $640,000 in gross revenue, not taking into account
right.
all the fees for the cameras. I mean, so like that $2 million estimate was like not even close.
Right.
So I guess going forward then, does your administration, when it comes time for your administration to make those kind of choices, does that experience inform how you do that?
Absolutely. So one of the things that we're looking at right now is an ambulance service for the fire department. And there are members of the fire department who want us to basically flip a switch and take over ambulance service in the city of Albany. And they say, here are 3 cities that did it and they made a bunch of money, which sounds hauntingly familiar, right? Because that's what we heard about red light cameras. I know it's far more complicated than that, particularly with the assaults on the Affordable Care Act, particularly when you look at our population and the number of uninsured, and the fact that there are a significant number of ambulance rides for which there's not reimbursement. And the city of Albany cannot be in the position of suing its residents for payment. I just don't see us being in that position or wanting to ever be in that position. And so it is something that we truly need to review and understand. There are going to be significant administrative expenses that we have to put in place. We cannot possibly administer ambulance service with the current staffing levels that we have. And so it's looking at what all of those costs are all in and what the potential revenue could be before we go down a path of saying yes to ambulance service. That said, I'm very interested in pursuing it. We are pursuing it, and it is something that we're looking at.
It's been many months now since the former police chief resigned to take a job with a national organization, and Albany still has an acting chief. So why do we not have a permanent police chief?
To engage in a search in the midst of the political environment that was created by this campaign, I thought would not do service to our residents, to our current chief, and to an overall process of engagement that I want to see happen as we decide who our next chief is. We have an incredibly competent acting chief who is doing an outstanding job. I am committed to a national search, yet I felt very strongly that given the tone and tenor that was being set by my opponent in this campaign, that it was just not an environment to do that because everything was becoming politicized. And that's just the honest, truthful answer to that.
So if you continue to be mayor and that search does happen, what are the qualities that you will be interested in for the next chief?
Well, I'm interested in hearing from our community with respect to what qualities they want to see in a chief. We have a police advisory committee, and I'll be relying on them to help with public engagement on that. What the search firm will do is, and we've already identified the search firm, and they're ready to move forward with the engagement. And so they do a community survey. They do a they'll do a profile of the city. Clearly, for me, this is a city that it has really demonstrated that it is leading with respect to 21st century policing strategies. And that's something that I will remain firmly committed to, a police department that is responsive to the community and that polices from the vantage point of being what the community wants it to be as opposed to telling the community what it's going to be. And so that is very important to me. I also want to see someone who can lead the department forward as we look at our economic challenges. You know, we have developed 21st century policing strategies. We've embraced those strategies. I know we have an outstanding department. The men and women on this department are committed. They're hardworking. They do an outstanding job. We need to make sure that this $54 million department, that we're also looking at making sure that we're managing it in a way that it's sustainable.
It would seem like one of the challenges of the next chief is that making sure a lot of the principles that the city has been talking about on the sort of executive level end up being implemented on the street. Because one thing that strikes me when I go to these, like for the meetings with the body cameras, it's like one person said to me, I love the chief. I love what he says. This is referring to the Brendan Cox. I love when he talks about what the department is doing. I'm not as convinced that that has filtered down to the actual officers on the street.
So we've been selected by the U.S. Department of Justice, as you know, as one of 15 police departments that's being used as a model to provide input and recommendations to police departments across the country. So the U.S. Department of Justice and the entities that they're working with have spent a lot of time in Albany. And I've met with them, and I've met with them privately. And they have said to me, this is not just coming from the top. We've talked to your beat officers, we've talked to your command staff, we've talked to your sergeants and lieutenants, and there has been a culture change in this department. Now, everybody is human, and our police officers do an unbelievably difficult job in circumstances that most ordinary people don't ever have to experience. And so I constantly, if I hear a complaint about how somebody believes that they were treated by a police officer, I encourage them. I say, please file a complaint. Unless we know about it, we cannot work with that officer. We can't respond. You know, we can't determine what course of action to take if we don't know about it. And so, you know, that that will be something that we will continue to do even after we have body cameras. I'm looking forward to the full rollout of body cameras. Every time we have the opportunity to be more transparent, that's a good thing. You know, there are those, some out there that have said that with respect to the occurrence that happened with Dante Ivey, that we didn't have cameras that were working. Yes, we did. The dashboard cameras were working. They're dashboard cameras. They don't shoot the sidewalk. So the cameras were doing exactly what they were supposed to do. They weren't designed to capture the area where the interaction with Dante Ivey occurred. I wish that they had. But again, that's why we are moving forward with body cameras, so that again, we can continue on our commitment to building trust and transparency with the community.
I'm glad that you brought up Dante Ivey, because I think that what happened, the situation surrounding him, has kind of fallen out of the conversation. But when you talk to people, you know, it's pretty clear that there's some, you know, serious scar tissue there, mm-hmm. In terms of the relationship between the community and the police in the city over what happened. So how does that help to be healed in some way?
Well, I mean, I was encouraged when a group of ministers, you know, probably about a year or so after the incident, did come to City Hall and on the steps of City Hall state that while they certainly weren't, were still concerned about what happened to Dante Ivey, that they believed that the department had done what it could and had been responsive to the requests that had been made for information and had been open and transparent about it, and that it was important for the community to move on and to try to heal. And so I was encouraged by that. I have, as you know, been called upon to fire the police officers who were involved in that stop. And I have said over and over again that my commitment to the residents of the city of Albany go beyond any two police officers, and that the commitment that I have in response to what happened to Dante Ivey is to continue to transform the way that we police in the city of Albany. And so in the face of a review by the U.S. Department of Justice, an investigation by the U.S. by the District Attorney's Office, and an internal investigation that found that these officers did not engage in any wrongdoing, had I terminated those police officers, they would have been able to sue the city and they would have gotten their jobs back. It is very clear that they would have been entitled to reinstatement. That whole process might have made people feel better, but it would have cost us hundreds of thousands of dollars that we wouldn't be able to spend trying to transform this police department. And I think if you look at what we've done, whether it's the implicit bias training or the commitment to train all of our police officers on spotting and dealing with mental health issues, creating our own police academy, the continued investments that we make in community engagement and in community policing, that to me, that is the work that is really difficult. Firing two officers would not result in the change that we have seen and that we've been able to effect by committing to the community that we've got to make sure that our officers are trained the way that our community wants them to be trained. And so that is the legacy and that's the commitment that I've made. And I completely understand those who are not satisfied with that answer. But again, when you're the mayor and you sit in this seat and you have to make decisions, you know, I would hope that people would at least acknowledge that my decision was a principled decision that was based on what I think is in the best interest of our city.
The city landfill is going to close either end of 2022 or beginning of 2023. And this has been like this asteroid that has been, you know, headed toward the city now for a number of years. Like, we've all known this is coming and everybody talks about it, but not a lot necessarily seems to have been done in terms of actually making concrete changes to prepare for that. So why is the city not further along in a plan for that?
I think that we're where we expected to be. We had solid waste management plan that was developed under the prior administration. That plan was approved by the council, I believe, in early 2014. And we are moving forward with the implementation of that plan. And we have continued to extend the life of the landfill. I think when you look at my record, I've been working on this and trying to avoid the asteroid since I became city treasurer. And we are now at a point where we are far less dependent on the cash from the landfill than we were in the prior administration. That cash hid a structural deficit that had existed for years. So we have eliminated that. Now the revenue that we get from the landfill covers the debt service and the operating expenses. So we're no longer dependent on that landfill to balance the city budget, because when the landfill closes, the debt service will be paid off. And the operating expense of the landfill itself will be dramatically reduced from about nearly $4 million a year to approximately $70,000 a year as we monitor it going forward. That said, we're going to have a new expense, right? We're going to have to dispose of our garbage somewhere else. And so that's the piece of this that we are methodically working at ensuring we can drive down to the lowest common denominator. That means we've got to get better at picking up garbage. That means that we've got to get better at recycling. And that means that we've got to look at what are the options that are available, particularly through a public-private partnership, to dispose of our garbage, whether that's separating organics, partnering on a regional basis with an alternative to landfills. But this is, again, where ambition meets reality, and I'm not going to promise unicorns and puppies. The reality is that to site an organics facility, to site an incinerator or a burn facility or a waste-to-energy facility can take a decade. We don't have a decade, and we've known that we don't have a decade. You know, that would have had to have started well underway under the prior administration. And so we are going to have to be realistic about what the right approach is. But to suggest that I would ever condone an approach that requires us to feed a beast, which is my terminology, you know, we owned a landfill and we had an incentive to feed the beast. That will not be a solution that will be acceptable as we move forward.
When people go into that booth on Tuesday, what is the one message from you that you want to be playing in their heads?
That I have committed to this city to change the way that we run the city of Albany, to change the way that we govern the city of Albany, and I've delivered on that promise. And that we are a city that has grown its tax base, that has tackled a lot of the challenges that people have wanted us to tackle, and that has tremendous potential. And that the focus of the next 4 years needs to be on connecting our residents to jobs and on rebuilding our neighborhoods, and that I've built the foundation to do that. Now is not the time to move backwards. Now is not the time to go back to the old ways of doing things. It's the time to stay the course, to continue to move the city forward. And I would be privileged to have their vote and to continue the work that we've done and the direction that we're taking the city.